originally Ugandan. Uganda is a small little country in the eastern part of Africa. We pride ourselves as one of those most handsome looking people. Churchill described us as the pearl of Africa. And so when the British left us this country right out of independence, we were so excited about it. In fact, my parents were teachers at the time. I remember the joy. And they had this incredible...
That's Derek Kayongo talking. We've got his incredible story for you today, filled with turns, tragedy, hope, and soap. Lots and lots of soap. Today, they all come together as one. This is Crazy Good Turns. We tell stories about people who do amazing things for others. I'm your host, Brad Shaw. Derek Kayongo makes quite an impression. He's the CEO of the Center for Civil and Human Rights in downtown Atlanta, and you gotta see him in person. Tall, lean, handsome, as he's the first to tell you. He's 46 years old, and most obviously, he dresses with flamboyance. The same outfit can feature plaid, stripes, polka dots, bright orange, purple, yellow, all living in a brazen sartorial bliss on Derek's lanky frame. He speaks with color, too, and honesty. He has grand ideas about battling inequality and where he wants to lead the Center for Civil and Human Rights. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Even all of this pales when compared to how he got here. Growing up in Uganda, his family, mother, father, four siblings, living and working in the specter of one of the most brutal dictators the world has ever known, Idi Amin. If you haven't read up on your African history lately, it's okay. We're here to provide scant details. Uganda was ruled by British colonialism from the late 1800s, but that fell apart in 1962. The Brits leaving the country free to rule its own destiny for the first time in the 20th century. A young country with a lot of growing pains ahead. Derek and his family lived in Kampala. His parents were teachers, but the low pay led them to build their own businesses. His mother, Miriam, taught herself how to be a tailor, and she became a successful entrepreneur making wedding dresses, colorful wedding dresses.
And I remember she didn't have mannequins for flower girl dresses. And so guess who the mannequin was? It was me. So my son hates this joke, but I love it very much because I remember cross-dressing a lot. Courtesy of my mom. So I enjoyed colors very quickly. Blues, yellows, pinks, all became part of my fashion lexicon. On the other side, my dad became a soap maker, and he taught himself how to make soap and built enterprise around that. And with him, I remember our kitchen being filled with experiments of different kinds of smells, you know, the origami and the teas and just different interesting smells that traveled through our apartment. And so here we were with two parents, all busy like little ants building an anthill to protect themselves from poor economy.
Derek describes himself as viciously vivacious as a child.
I was a playful child. I loved to run. I remember we had events where we played with African toys, and African toys are totally different from the Western toys.
What are they like?
We would take barbed wire and straighten the wire out and design cars and make real cars out of them. We would take sandals and cut rubber out of them to make tires for the cars. We would take bamboo sticks to make steering wheels out of them. And we would just rest with them. Or we would take soda pop cups, you know, the Pepsi or Coke cups, tops, and we would make drafts. The game is called drafts. It's a, I don't know what they call them in America, but checkers or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we'd use bottle caps.
And this is till what age, roughly?
Till about age 10.
10. And then what happened?
And then Idi Amin, who at the time was our leader, who was born out of this reprobate agenda, had a very little education experience, became president. And that immediately shifted the dynamic in the country. that vivaciousness, that excitement around this incredible country to be, became narrowed down to a very myopic view of what a nation is through his eyes.
Idi Amin, again, as a refresher, was a major general in the Ugandan army who basically stole the country from the prime minister in a military coup in 1971. From that point until 1979, he basically killed anyone who disagreed with him. His regime was blamed for the deaths of up to 500,000 people, and that killing hit close to young Derek. Fair warning, some of the stories Derek is about to tell are very disturbing.
People started to disappear. Commodities like sugar, salt started to disappear. He started to victimize his own cabinet members, hanging them. But I think what struck me the most, and when I knew we were in trouble, was when he killed the archbishop of the country, accusing him of having slandered him. And that's when you know things are really in a bad situation. I woke up one night, my father actually woke us up after hearing some gunshots out of our apartment. And he looked out and realized there were soldiers everywhere, swarming. And very quickly, there were gunshots fired. And in Arabic Bantu, which is also Swahili, this man spoke out these very horrific words, "Get out of your apartments right now. Get out."
Derek and his family were rounded up with countless others at a local bus station. A soldier told the crowd that two of his fellow soldiers had been killed.
That he was there to find out who did it, and he was going to have a firing squad until we told him what happened. Now, in any civilized society, whenever a crime is committed, you'd imagine policing and investigating. He did not do that. And so here we were faced with an incredible destiny. And it was a bridging moment because you move from being a wealthy child with wealthy parents, going to private school, and now you're faced with an incredible proposition, death by a firing squad. So he proceeded to pick two people out, another two, that was four. He said for them to come to the forefront. He asked the question again, who killed these two soldiers? And to no avail, he pulled out his pistol and shot all four of them. Dead. Point blank. Cries of mothers holding their children and just sheer mayhem. And he yelled out again using his bullhorn, "Be quiet, be quiet. Everybody be quiet." And we got to be quiet. And he said, "We're going to do this all day." So he pointed out another four. And as he did that, I remember he was met with an incredible experience because as he pointed people started to point at their neighbors.
Four more people were picked out of the crowd.
And he shot all four of them at once. That was eight. Before he could pick up another four, a young man rose up his hand and said he had committed the crime, of which we knew he was lying because he was a visitor of the village. And so they brought him up, and there was a little bit of banter. And a gunshot rang out as loudly as it could have.
You were 10 years old when you saw this.
Yes.
Right? The last man shot didn't commit the crime, correct?
Correct.
So he sort of willingly gave his life for everyone else in the village.
This was meant to be.
Stories like this remind us these were incredibly dark times in Uganda, and it got worse. Over the course of weeks, months, young Derek commonly witnessed corpses lying in the street for days, for weeks, and no one would move them. If you moved the body, that meant you must have a close connection to that person, and so you'd be killed too.
As a young child, seeing birds eating dead bodies and dogs eating, this is not a way to live.
One afternoon in school, an employee who worked for Derek's dad knocked on the schoolroom door and had a conversation with the teacher. Derek could tell by the look of shock on his teacher's face that something was horribly wrong.
In my whole life, I'd always heard about other kids' parents kidnapped or killed, and so I'd always said, wow, I hope this never happens to my father, my mother. And sure enough, she looked at me and said, "Derek, can you please come to the front?" I was a backbencher. And so I came to the front, and she said to me, "You need to go home." I said, why? And she said, your father's been kidnapped. Do you need to go home?
Most kidnappings resulted in death, right?
Oh, yes, hangings. Yeah. There were, And so we got to this home, and sure enough, there was almost 20 people there. It was almost like a funeral. Mm-hmm. So that's when I knew this is not going to end well.
But he escaped?
Yeah, he did more than escape. I think he bribed. He paid off some money and used some connections to be freed.
What was it like when you saw him the first time after that?
You know what is funny is I'd never seen my father cry before, ever in my life. In fact, I think it's very traditional for African fathers to cry. It's not acceptable. As we were there waiting to see what news was, it was about, at this time it was about 6 p.m., a little motorbike came by, and he was at the back of the motorbike. I didn't have words. I was like, wow, this dad. And he came into the room where everybody had been gathered, and he sat down and just cried.
The family had no choice. Faced with the ever-increasing threat of violence and death, they fled to Kenya. From upstanding, wealthy citizens filled with hope of their country's independence to impoverished refugees just struggling to survive, they lived next to Kibera, one of the largest slums in the world, and where Derek's sister went to school.
To get there, Daisy, my little sister, was the young girl to be in that school. And to get there, you'd go through over sewer systems that were broken. Ramshackled homes, rats, just trash everywhere. So the smells were odious. The sounds of poverty are different from the sounds of wealth. Tins being smashed to make stoves, burning of trash, just different sounds and smells.
Derek remembers his mother holding the family together during that time.
She had us sing every weekend, and we would have skits, and we would play out little role things. And then that has always been our saving grace. We always sang, we always played skits. We didn't have TV, we didn't have books, we didn't have anything. So she would reenact all these little things for us. And that's how we kept going.
Eventually, Idi Amin's stranglehold on Ugandan power weakened, and war broke out. Derek's father, Tom, went back to fight in the war, and Amin was ousted in 1979. Tom Kayongo went on to become a member of parliament and deputy director of their version of RCIA. His mother, Miriam, fought for women's rights and helped found the Ministry of Women. They both still live in Uganda. So this is where the story could end happily. Derek's parents, content and successful. His siblings, growing up and making a living, and free. But colorful Derek has never been one to settle. He had a set of experiences that helped him view the world in a very unique way. He also had a strong desire to do some good. Eventually, he made his way to America to go to school at Tufts University. He half jokes that his only knowledge of African-American culture was from the Eddie Murphy movie Coming to America. One of the first times he ever stayed at a hotel in Philadelphia in the early 90s, his innocence actually turned into its own comedy, and then, improbably, into a personal mission he couldn't deny.
And I'd never really been in a hotel. And so I got in there, and the hotel was so copacetic and beautiful, and the room was clean and immaculate. A picture white linens and big pillowcases, and wow.
Far cry from where you came from.
Yeah. So I was like, wow, this is really fantastic. And I walked into the bathroom, and there I saw something even much more interesting, soap. Three kinds of soap, facial soap, body soap, and hand washing soap. That didn't include the shampoos in case you had nappy hair like I do. And I said, what is going on here? Why do they have soap for every part of their body? Because I'd grown up around soap. So I was cracking up with a wow. I said, wow, this is really wealth. So, but I realized, it's just soap. So I put the two bars away for another day because I didn't have any soap with me. So I figured I would need it down the road. And I came back that evening and they had replaced all the soaps. Okay. I'm African, I'm going to steal the heck out of those soaps. So I put those in my bag as well. And I kept on stealing soap for about 3 days.
So what, you have like 15 bars of soap?
But then quickly realized that the nobility of Americans has always been that there's no free lunch in this country.
Yep.
They're going to charge me for it. So I took all the stolen goods downstairs to the concierge and asked him to take them back.
What did he say?
I told him that I had been stealing soap. And he said, what? From housekeeping? I said, no, you keep on bringing me soap and I can't afford it. And I keep on bringing it away. But, you know, just here you go, take it back. Have them not charge me for it because I can't afford it. And he bloody burst out of laughter. He said, you know, young man, all these Americans you see traversing this hotel, they all steal soap. So you're good, brother. So we had a little bit of fun with that. And he said, it's part of the hotel bill. So I said, okay, fine. And as I said to walk away, a thought struck me. And that was, what about the partially used spa? Like, could I have that as well if I was living? Cause so I walked back to him. I said, what about the partially used bar? Do you guys take those as well, or do you leave it behind? What happens? He said, well, no, we throw those out. I said, what? He said, you throw those out. I said, the hotel or every hotel in the U.S. throws them out? He says, every hotel in the U.S. throws them out. That's the law. We throw every little piece out. When I went back upstairs, that's when I lost it. Because then the epiphany for me had happened. Here I was, a child of a man who made soap, became very well-to-do. And then I became the child of that man who had become a refugee and saw the power and need for soap. Diarrhea, childbed fever, or ringworm, all the diseases that soap fights or helps to mitigate. I had sin as a refugee. That's when, for me, all the events that I had gone through started to make sense. I had been brought to the U.S. to solve a problem.
Yep, hope in soap. The same soap he watched his father make when he was a child. Something that most of us are lucky enough to take for granted on a grand scale. By Derek's count, the U.S. throws away 800 million bars of soap every year. 2.6 million bars of soap every single day. The stuff that in third world countries can save millions of lives by improving sanitation and hygiene. So Derek set out on a long mission to figure out how to get all this hotel soap to third world countries. Because of FDA requirements, it's not as easy as filling hotel pillowcases with mini soap bars and shipping them off to Africa. Even for the son of a soap maker, it wasn't easy. But Derek graduated college, got good jobs with Amnesty International and CARE, and in his spare time researched how he might negate the third world's soap shortage with the U.S.'s bubbling abundance.
How do you recycle soap? What's the process?
The first step is to separate the soaps by color. When they come in from the different hotels, they have different colors, blues, yellows, and whites. And so once you do that, then you peel the first layer off, which is what you use in the hotel room. We then get into the inside part of the soap. Fortunate for us, the germs don't have a drilling mechanism to drill deep into the beds of the soap to stay there. So they're usually on top of the soap. So that's the first mode of cleaning the soap. Then the second thing is we crush it into powder form. And the reason we're doing that is that we're going to sort of ziplock it for a little bit and give the germs another chance to disappear. Mm-hmm. Because they're like you, they need oxygen, they need food, they need water. And then we awaken the soap with a little bit of moisture. Because if it's too dry, it's not going to stay together. So you've got to make it turn into a feta cheese texture. And out of that, based on whatever formulation we have, we are then able to put it back into the machine. We have a big, huge machine that then compresses the soap into a big bar. And then in the process, heating the soap to a particular degree of heat, which is part of our little secret. And that process still killing the germs, but not compromising the pH system or the chemistry of the soap. And so out comes a long, beautiful new bar. And then we take those bars with their beautiful smells. Just imagine just this machine just cranking out long bars of soap. And then they are cut into small slices of 6 ounce bars. And then we create what we call a batch. And that batch is where we take samples, because the FDA has to have us test them for pathogens. We test for 12 pathogens.
So that is a pretty complex process. How long did it take you from your epiphany to actually producing soap to, you know, formulate that process?
Well, 10 years, because I was new to the country. You just don't come in and just start right off the bat. I had forgotten how to really make soap.
Derek and his wife, Sarah, founded the Global Soap Project in 2009. The organization is now making about 10 million bars of soap a year, sending them to about 100 countries around the world, including those suffering from national disasters or human-made disasters. Ebola in Liberia and West Africa, the earthquake in Haiti. And they've partnered with organizations like the Centers for Disease Control, Care International, and Physicians for Health. We've said it before, this podcast is about good turns. This is a remarkable turn, from refugee to soap savior. And if that's not enough, we mentioned earlier that Derek is now leading the high-profile Center for Civil and Human Rights. Of course, he has big plans for the center.
Well, I think that there's several dialogues globally right now. Mm-hmm. Some of those dialogues have a lot to do with the common denominator around the need for us to understand each other. There's a lot of violence going on right now in the Middle East, in Africa, and other parts of the world that is uncalled for. And I think that what we are trying to do here at the center is to remind all of us that the one most important dialogue is to really find a way for all of us to understand to live together in peace.
And one last turn. The Center for Civil and Human Rights has a special section reserved for life-size cutouts of the world's worst dictators. Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, and brooding among them, the likeness of Idi Amin. Derek is reminded every day where he came from and what kind of world he wants to help create. As our interview wrapped up, Derek and I strolled up to Idi Amin and stood face to face with him. When you see him there among the most evil men to walk the earth, the first thing you notice is his size. He was 6'4 with a massive frame, the biggest of the despots.
It's impressive, actually. He's a big boy.
He's the biggest of all of these despots, really. I mean, he's huge.
He was such a reprobate. He was such an incredible individual. But yeah, he's the tallest of all of them.
When you look at him, what do you feel? Is it resentment, anger, fear?
Oh, a lot of resentment. I you know, my family lost everything. You know, I look at my country and where we are, and he destroyed a whole group of people. So I'm very resentful of him.
Derek obviously has every reason to resent Idi Amin, but that's probably the only bone of human resentment in his body. The first time I met Derek, I reached out for a handshake, which he ignored. Instead, he hugged me. And not one of those half-assed bro hugs, but a full-on big giant bear hug, belly to belly. When we all showed up for this interview at the Center for Civil and Human Rights, he hugged me again. Then he hugged our sound guy, Steven, and our project manager, Megan.
Why do you hug people?
Energy. Energy is so important. I think that modern societies have forgotten the personalization of our energies and why that is important. That when you give a hug versus the sort of standoffish approach, that you create an opening mm-hmm. in that person's friendship. We hugged a lot back at home, because the handshake wasn't enough. We needed each other. I think that in the struggle to be human, we forget that it's important to connect beyond just a handshake. So I hope that helps. I'm always a hugger.
I'm Brad Shaw, and thanks for listening to this episode of Crazy Good Turns. Go to crazygoodturns.org to learn more about the Global Soap Project and the Center for Civil and Human Rights, and to submit your ideas for extraordinary people and organizations we should feature.
So I told myself, I never let you go. Something
You might have noticed we found some great music to support our podcast, and we've provided a Spotify playlist of the full tracks on our website so you can take a longer listen, which we hope you'll do. And if you're a band with a song we should consider featuring, you can submit it on our website too. Crazy Good Turns is audio engineered by Stephen Key. Music supervision and mixing by Score School in Los Angeles. And a special thanks to Megan Basinger. We hope you like our podcast and help us out by sharing us in your social networks and giving us a review on iTunes. Take care and let's connect again soon.